This is an interview with Michael Papazoglou on Wednesday, 10 April 2013, at his holiday home in Moana. The interviewer is Helen Haldis, and the interview is being conducted as part of the Greek Migrant Experience, Oral Histories Project, an OIGA initiative. It is funded by the Australian Government's Your Community Heritage Program, Sharing Community Heritage Stories. Welcome, Michael, and thank you very much in agreeing to take part in this project. Can we start by you giving us your full name for the recording?
My name is Michael Papazoglou.
And where were you born, Michael?
I was born in a small village of Gliko Kerasha in the prefecture of Kozani in Greece.
And when were you born?
I was born on the 15th of February 1942.
And your parents, where were they born?
Both of my parents were born in Asia Minor, in the area of Pontus. They're both Pontian Greeks.
Mm-hmm. We'll start with your dad. Exactly where was your dad born?
My dad was born in a village in the area of Bafra. He was born in 1902. As far as they could tell, because they didn't have the records with them when they came over to Greece.
Mm-hmm. And let's talk a little bit about how your dad came to be in Kozani.
Well, with a lot of other millions of Greeks that were living in Asia Minor for centuries, after the First World War, there was a war between Greece and Turkey, and in that upheaval, most of the Greeks were sent away more or less by the Turks. A lot of them went into exile. A lot of them went into the hills as guerrilla fighters, trying to save themselves and their families. And my father was one of those that went into the hills for a couple of years.
As a young man?
As a young man. He was with the guerrillas, but he never took a rifle because being one of the youngest that was with the guerrillas, and because they didn't have all that much guns and ammunition. They had a policy of for every fighter there should be five people that will sort of carry the staff and look after other areas of the struggle. After a period of over 2 years hiding in the hills and in the mountains, there was an agreement. And the war finished between Greece and Turkey, and there was an agreement between the two governments that there should be an exchange of populations. And my father got in the town of Samsunda together with his family and other extended family, his family being his mother and his sister. And from Samsunda, they got onto an American ship that brought them to Constantinople. Now, there is an interesting story there. The port in Samsunda is not deep enough for the big ships to go to port, so they had to be ferried by boat to the American ship that was waiting on anchor. And they paid this Turkish fella to take them across. There was eight of them, and they paid him whatever they paid him. When they were halfway, he said, you either give me a gold coin each, a gold sovereign for each person, which meant eight golden sovereigns, or I'll dump you in the sea. Apparently my grandmother had some gold coins hidden in the hem of her dress. So she paid him the eight sovereigns, and they got onto the ship, and that she was left with only two gold sovereigns for the trip to come back to Greece. Now, in Constantinople, they stayed at an old army barracks for about 40 days, as my father was saying, where he got sick. He didn't know from what, but his mother got sick as well, and she died, and she's buried in Constantinople. After that, they got onto a Greek ship and they come to Thessaloniki.
That was your brother and his
father. My father and his sister that disembarked in Thessaloniki together with other relatives, extended family, and other people from the same village and from the same areas. After Thessaloniki, they went to this village in Kozani. The thing was that they were sent more or less there because that's where the Turks that had left from Greece in the exchange of the populations. There was the houses that were empty and the properties that the Turks had in the exchange process. The Greeks from Turkey had to take the properties from the Turks, and the Turks from Greece had to take the property from the of the Greeks in Turkey. So that's why he ended up in the village of Gliko Kerasha in the prefecture of Kozani.
Isn't that amazing?
In a nutshell, his my father's story.
Well, how old was he by the time he reached Kozani?
He was a 20-year-old.
Young man. Mm. Mum has a little bit of a different story.
Yeah, Mum's story is fairly different in the sense that although my father's village, they were able to escape the Turks and run into the hills, my mother's village did not have, not all of it anyway, did not have that luck. The Turks got there and they rounded them up and they sent them into exile. Now, apparently that was a policy of the Turkish government at the time. They gathered together a lot of Pontian Greeks, and they sent them with the army. They had the army sort of taking them from one place to another inside Turkey. Now, when they reached the first town that they took them, there were about 3,500 of them. And they kept walking right through Turkey, eastern Turkey. They went into Syria. They went into Mesopotamia. And 2.5 years later, they ended up in Beirut, in present-day Lebanon. Of course, you've got to remember all those areas were Turkish. So they were just taking them from one place to another. It was very hard because they could only take whatever they could carry with them. And this thing lasting for years. I mean, at the end, there was nothing left. And they used to, on the road, they used to beg different areas and different villages that they went through. Or if they stayed in one place more than, a week or 2 weeks, they tried to get some sort of job so people can offer them, just feed them, nothing else. There was no question of paying for the work. As my mother used to say, it was a very difficult time. It wasn't unusual to sleep at night under open skies and wake up in the morning with about 0.5 meter of snow on top of you. There was also the other menace that at night time, where they sort of stopped, there were gangs of youths from the surrounding villages, from wherever they stayed. They used to run into the camp and grab the girls. A lot of girls, as she was saying, had vanished that way. A lot of people sort of slept at night and didn't wake up in the morning. A lot of people sort of fell down as they were walking and never stood up. To get the picture of the whole thing, I think it's best to say this, that out of the 3,500 people that started that journey, 2 years later, in Beirut reached only 600. They stayed in Beirut for about 6 months. There they had them in some sort of camp, but they were allowed to go out and see if they can find some sort of work for their feet, nothing else. And my mother did go to a house and worked there for about a month. The husband was Turkish, Muslim. The wife was Greek from Athens, and she was speaking Greek. And so my mother could sort of understand what they wanted her to do. And among other things, you know, she went to other houses as well. And 6 months later, after the exchange of population was arranged between the two countries, a Greek ship took them to the port of Piraeus in Athens. All this time, she had her father with her. And there were two of them, plus the extended family and the other villages. Now, in Piraeus, they put them into quarantine for 40 days. When I first heard the story, I didn't know what quarantine was, and my mother explained it, and I asked why she didn't know. And to other people that I've asked, nobody knew why they put them in quarantine, but obviously the government or the authorities set their reasons. After the quarantine, they were told to go north, where the places were more empty, where the Turks had left. So they ended up walking north. My grandfather died outside of Larissa in the town of Tirnavos. They said he drank water from some spring that had poison or glass or something, but it probably was malaria. That was the thing later. Anyway, my mother carried on and came to the village of Omali in the prefecture of Kozani, which is next to Glikokerasha, where my father was. After a while, we're talking weeks now, these people that were there, they were given houses, wherever there was available. But in order to get some land, farmland, they only gave farmland to families. So my father did not have a family. He had his sister who had died as soon as they reached the village. So he was on his own. And being on his own, he would not be entitled to get any land. And he wasn't the only one. Other people were in the same boat. So in order to get land, they had to get married. So my father saw my mother somewhere in one of the neighbor's houses and asked this and that. And they ended up getting married 2 or 3 days later in order to be able to get some land. And that was in early 1923, as far as I can remember, of what they had said.
Now, going back to Bondos, when your parents were there as young people, were they able to go to school and learn the Greek language?
Now, my mother was in an area where most of the villages were Greek, and they spoke the Pontian dialect. My mother did not go to school at all. She was completely illiterate. Although there was school available, but she had the problem that when she was 8, her mother died, so she sort of looked after the family, and the other thing was that girls weren't supposed to need education in those days. She only spoke the Pontian dialect, and she only learned Turkish when she married my father. Now, my father's story is in this respect a bit different too. Where he was born, most of the villages around, or let's say most of the population was Turkish. The Greeks were a minority in that area. Consequently, they had lost their language. Now, that happened probably generations ago. My father, they had a school at his village. He went first grade, and when they started the second grade, the Turks closed the school, and they took the teacher away. So although he could write his name, and he could basically recognize the writing, but his language skills in Greek were very limited. He was a Turkophone, a Turkophonos. So when they came to Greece in that village, most of them were from the same village from Pontus, and most of them spoke only Turkish. So my mother had to learn the Turkish language as a must, because everybody spoke it. And any other girl that married any Endopio girl, or a Greek girl from Greece that married in that village, and they were a couple that I knew later in life, they all had to learn the language. It was one of those things, otherwise you could not get along. That's as far as that goes. The other thing that comes to mind is this, that these people, although they were from small villages, and especially my mother's area was apparently the high country, they were people who knew what they wanted. My uncle, my mother's brother, went to school in Trapezunda. Now, he was going to be a teacher when he finished. He knew five languages apparently: Greek, obviously, Turkish, English, French, and Russian. He died when he was 23 from some sort of sickness. Now, my father's family was rather well-to-do, apparently. They had, economically, they were very well-to-do, but they had the misfortune that my uncle, my father's elder brother, Michael, whose name I have, died in Skidra in the Balkan Wars. He was conscripted in the Turkish army. My grandfather was conscripted in the Turkish army, but they weren't actually given, this was during the First World War, they weren't actually taken to the front. They were made to work in road gangs. And the conditions were that harsh that apparently about 90% of them perished. I know my grandfather perished. The only thing that we know of from the time that he was conscripted, a letter that he sent to his wife back in the village, asking her to pay whatever it takes to get him out of that. Apparently, if you paid enough, you could get out. And my grandmother, well, she went and found some Turk somewhere and gave him whatever gold coins, sovereigns he asked for, but my father never came back. So what happened, whether he just got the money and did nothing about it, he couldn't do anything about it, or it was too late, nobody knows. Yes, their life was very hard.
Now, did they have freedom to practice their Greek Orthodox religion?
They were free to practice their, yes, they were free as far as worshipping. They had the churches. The churches, They never closed, as far as I know. From that side of things, yes. But the thing is, whenever there was an upheaval or something, it was the done thing that the Turks would go to the Greek villages and kill and burn and, plunder. And that apparently had been going on for generations, because, as my father was saying, when they left, his village was 160 years old. I'm sorry, 120 years old. They had come from another area because of whatever had happened. Nobody knew from my father's side. Apparently the Turks had gone and burned the village and killed a few, and whoever escaped, they left that area and went and established another village somewhere else. It always depended on who was the Sultan and how he viewed the Christians. But as far as my parents ever said anything, was that the church was never closed. They were always allowed to practice their religion. I've got to quantify that by saying that in my father's village, the liturgy was done in the Turkish language. We still have the letters of what you call it, the Apostolos, which is in Greek letters and English words, in Turkish words. That was how they kept their faith. They lost their language, they kept their faith, and they had translated all their religious books into what they call the Karamanlidika, or Greek letters and Turkish words. We still have a couple of books. My brother Paul has them.
That's yes. Wonderful. That's really good. Now, even though they were getting on quite well in Turkey, in Bondos, but due to unfortunate circumstances, they found themselves in Greece. Now, when they went to Greece, how did the Greeks in Greece see these people that were coming back?
Well, they did not like it. They did not want them. They used to say, and that I heard it in my time too, "I hope the boat that brought you over should have sunk." There was different cultures, especially with people that did not speak the Greek language. And even the ones like my mother, who did not speak Turkish at all, they spoke the Pontian dialect, which is it's a Greek language, but it's quite different to the spoken Greek language. So there was a lot of prejudice the first years. It wasn't the dumb thing that a refugee, as our people were called, a refugee boy will marry a Greek girl. That wasn't, unless the girl wasn't, was from a very poor family, or, didn't have a good reputation, or she was that not good looking that nobody wanted her. Yeah, and that carried on to the time that I can remember. Now, I'm not saying the state did this. It's what the people did between themselves. Now, as far as the state is concerned, I think they did the best to their ability, because we have to remember that Greece had a war, was in the First World War. They had a war with Turkey, which they lost. And then they had 1.5 million people came with nothing but what they had, what they wore on themselves. So they had to sort of look after them. And with all the shortcomings and whatever, I think, and my parents used to say that, they did whatever they could. But things were tough.
Mm-hmm. So your parents married, and How? What do they do for a living?
Well, that's fairly obvious. They worked on the land. They gave him, what is it? About 10 acres of land, to which, for the standards of the time and for the standards of Greece, was a fair amount of land, one on which a family is supposed to sort of live. And they start cultivating, and they had a family. They had 8 kids. 2 of them died in infancy. One died of polio at 13 years of age. He was a bit older than me. And 5 of us survived, 4 boys and 1 girl. They work hard. That was one of the things that I heard from people when I was growing up, that they used to say that the way these prosperous, these refugees worked the first years, it was unbelievable. But they had to, because there was no other choice.
They had nothing. They came with
They had
nothing.
Nothing. They came with nothing. So the state gave them the house, which was good. They gave him the land. And I believe the first couple of years they gave him some seed. Otherwise they could not plow, could they?
Mm-hmm.
Or so.
What do you remember of your childhood?
My childhood, I vaguely remember the Civil War, which was a terrible thing that came after World War II. I remember they got us from the village and they took us to a town called Tsotili, and we stayed there for almost, if I remember correctly, a couple of years. That's where I went first grade school, and I finished it there, so that's 1 year. And we had gone there earlier, I was too young, other kids used to go to school and I didn't. So I assume it was almost 2 years that we stayed in that town. And there was all the villages of the whole area were in that town. They did that in order to starve the guerrillas from supplies. And apparently it worked.
Who's they? Who's they? Who moved you?
The government. The government. The Greek government that took over when the Germans left. And of course the civil war was between the right wing and the left wing, and that lasted from 45, 46 to 49. I remember the end bit of it. I remember that we went to Tsotili. I remember when the night that they came and broke in, the guerrillas came and broke in and took our livestock. I suppose they needed, because they were starving. And I remember the night that the last battle was fought in Gramos. I remember distinctly the, what do you call them, the things that you send up, not firecrackers, but photovoltaics. The flares. I remember seeing them, because the mountains not all that far, we could see. That was the last battle of the Civil War.
What did these guerrillas want? Why did we have a civil war?
Well, the civil war was the left wing did not want wanted a democratic Greece without a king. The king had come back, the English had brought the king back, and they had installed a government who was, right wing, and they used a lot of the people that during the German occupation were with the German army, were actually fighting alongside the German army, and those people then became the mainstay of the Greek police and the Greek army. Well, the left wing, the EAM and the LAS people did not stand for it. one thing led to the other, I don't think it's appropriate to go into the detail of the thing.
No, not necessarily.
The fact is that there was a civil war, and I think out of all the occupied countries in Europe, Greece was the only one that had the civil war, which is a pity. And whatever destructions the Germans didn't do, it was completed amongst the Greeks. And when I say destructions, I know my family story. As we said, my parents came from Turkey in 1923. They established themselves, they established a family. And in 1944, whatever livestock or whatever provisions they had, 1944, the German army did the last time they went in our area, they took everything. So the people were left with almost nothing, or were left with whatever they could hide. All right, the Germans left, and people started working again, my family the same thing, and they started establishing themselves again. My father had a few livestock, a few cows, a few sheep, a few goats. In 1948, the guerrillas took them. So he was left with nothing again. Now, when we went from Tsotili, when we went back to our village, all we had was a mule that the government had. Well, not actually the government, it was the United Nations Relief Agency that gave my father. He wasn't the only one, other people got stuff too. And the only thing that life we had was that mule. And with that mule, my father worked, carrying people up and down, carrying stuff, and trying to feed his family until the next season where the crops would come up again. I remember coming back from school, and if there was a slice of bread with a bit of sugar, that was a treat. Mostly there was no sugar, and we had to eat just a slice of bread. These things I do remember, I experienced them myself. It was hard times, very hard times. Financially, people were ruined because, well, from 1940 to 1949, in our area at least, there was always war. Always people getting killed and properties get confiscated and all that.
Mm-hmm. Now, you said they, the authorities moved you to a safe place. I've heard that they did that because they wanted to protect the children as well. Was there a danger of children being taken away?
That is a story that I've heard too, because they say that the guerrillas used to take the children, which I know for cases where it happened. But all the people that I know, and I know quite a few that were taken, were people that their families were with the guerrillas.
That's interesting, isn't it?
I don't know, and I've asked a lot of people here if they can point out to somebody's kid that was taken and with their parents being in the village or in the town or whatever. Nobody has been able to tell me. I know that fella, that happened. They used to take their own kids. Or if I was killed and my wife was killed, or she was in prison, and my brother was with the guerrillas in the mountains, he will come back and get my kids. That's how it happened, as far as I know. And I beg to, you know, to find out somebody who can tell me that, you know, no, they took other kids as well. I don't know. But the main reason that they took us to towns was to starve the guerrillas of supplies, because the guerrillas used to come to villages and grab whatever they could find, because obviously they had to survive. That's part of the guerrilla warfare. that was happening even in the days of the Turkish occupation with the Kleftes and the Armatoli. Apparently that worked. It was a successful policy because at the end the government won the fight.
Mm-hmm. All right, so it was a very difficult period. And when everything's calmed down, you went back to your village. Australian migration that started in the early 50s, and you must have been aware, or the whole family or people from your own villages heard that Australia had opened its doors and they wanted workers. Did your family think of coming to Australia at that time?
Yes, very interesting you should ask that. My father, because of all those things that happened around him and to him, he wanted to leave that place, that area. For the first time in 1948, he tried to come to Australia, but nobody knew the reasons why that failed. Anyway, after the Civil War finished and whatever, migration started again, this time on a bigger scale, my elder brother George applied to come to Australia, which he did. He left Greece in December of 1953, and he came to Australia in January of 1954. A few years later, he nominated to bring the rest of the family, which is me, my brother, my younger brother Paul, and my two parents. That was in about 1956, but then the Suez Canal closed and they had problems there, and that stopped. But my father kept wanting to come, to leave Greece. So in 1958, again, my brother nominated us through the immigration department, and eventually we managed, the four of us, to come in September of 1959 to Australia.
Your brother came across with the Australian government's assisted passage, is that right?
Yes, he came with assisted passage, and they went to Bonikila first. I don't know how long he stayed there. From there, they sent him to some farms in Mildura Way, grape picking, whatever you. And from there, him and some other friends that he made, or people that he came on the ship with, they came to Adelaide, and he stayed there, and that's where we ended up coming to Adelaide when we migrated to Australia.
So he invites the family to come across, and he paid for your tickets to come across?
No, my brother did not pay. My father paid the fares. By that time, we were financially a lot better, of course, and that was the reason that I personally did not want to come. But as a 17-year-old, my parents would not leave me behind. I begged them to leave me behind, but that was to no avail. So even though I did not want to come, I ended up coming because the family wanted to come and I had no choice in the matter.
Why didn't you want to come?
I had a feeling that I'd do well there, and there was no need for me to migrate. Of course, talking with my father, his answer was, "You don't know. You don't remember. You was too young." And I used to say to him, "But that's happened. That's gone. That's in the past. You don't know. It might happen again. Get out of this country." He was fed up with it. It was difficult. They had difficult times. They were hard for them. I mean, I remember the things that I remember, and they were hard. Can you imagine having, you know, three or four kids and trying to raise them? It must have been awful for him.
Mm-hmm. You said earlier you had a sister as well. Did she come with you to Australia?
No, my sister had married in 1952. And she stayed back. Her husband actually went to Belgium in 1955 or 56. And she went to Belgium as well a few years later, but she only stayed there for a little while, not even a year, I don't think. When we were leaving for Australia, the arrangement was that they wanted to come back and stay in our place, in our village, in our house. So my sister came just before we left with her son, and we left, and a month later her husband came from Belgium too, and they stayed there. They're still there with their family.
Mm-hmm. All right, so you came across with a ship. Do you remember the name?
With a ship, yes.
Remember the name of the ship?
Yes, it was the ship Flaminia. It was an Italian ship. There were a lot of Italians. It was an interesting trip. Up to Aden, I was having a fantastic time. It was beautiful. That was the life. And then when we got onto the Indian Ocean, there was a bit of a weather, and it affected me. I got seasick. I could not eat much. And I practically suffered all the way to Fremantle. It was one of those things. Everybody was telling me, look, try, force yourself to eat, but I just couldn't. And whatever I put down, it was coming up. In Fremantle, when we got there, I was happy to step on land again, I tell you. I'll never forget that feeling. I was on solid ground. And we had, we went into a restaurant together with other people. And I ate there, and I ate a lot. And that lasted me until Melbourne. Yes, that was interesting. I could not eat the food in the ship, not because the food was bad, but because of the seasickness that I had.
Mm-hmm. Now, you didn't want to come, so you were coming up because you had to come. Once you arrived in Fremantle and you saw Australia, can you remember what you thought?
Well, it's interesting you ask that. As we were walking on Fremantle, about 10 or 15 of us, I heard this voice, and I looked up and I saw this kid. He was saying something in English, which I could not understand, but I saw a pile of papers in his hand. Obviously, the kid was selling papers, but he was barefoot. He had no shoes on. And I looked at him, and being barefoot in Greece was because you didn't have money to buy shoes. So I thought, there must be poverty here too. That was my first impression of Australia, which wasn't very good. And the other thing that, the other impression, not the best one, was when I saw the houses, they all had tin roofs. That was something unbelievable too. Yes.
Now in the ship, because you were coming to Australia, did they provide English lessons?
Yes, they did provide English lessons, and I attended a few days until we reached Aden. After that, I was so sick, I just gave it up. I couldn't. I remember the teacher running on to me a couple of times. Well, the teacher, the chap that taught us English. And he asked me, and I told him, he said, come on, that's an excuse, you can come. But I never did go, mm-hmm. No. Mm-hmm.
So from Fremantle, after that, you went to Port Melbourne?
Yes.
And who was there to greet you?
My brother came, George, from Adelaide with his car. So he picked us up and drove us to Adelaide.
Now, driving from Melbourne to Adelaide, can you remember, what were your thoughts?
I was impressed with the flatness of the country. And, of course, I hadn't seen anything like it. I knew from school that Australia was a flat country, but nothing like what I saw. And let's face it, even today you do that journey and there's nothing to see. It's not the best part of Australia, but there it was.
Right, so you arrive in Adelaide, and where did you stay?
We stayed up at Kerry's Gully, up in the Adelaide Hills, with people that I knew from Greece, and they were friends of my brother's, and we rented there for a while, for a few months. I got a job in a market garden at Lenswood, I was getting £7 a week as a 17, 18 year old. And then come the summertime, January or February, all the family went to Mildjuraway for grape picking, which was an interesting experience for us all, except George, of course, had done it before. And the thing that I will never forget, it was, I think, the first or second afternoon that we were working, and it was damn hot. And in the afternoon, George called us. We stopped, all right, for a break, and the farmer's wife came with a boiling tea and some cups, and she offered us to drink hot tea in a hot afternoon. I looked at George and said, what goes on? He goes, no, this is good for you. I said, what, in this weather, in this heat, hot tea? He goes, drink it and you'll realize how cool it is. I said, how can it be cool, man? Anyway, we drank it, and it obviously, yes, it had a cooling effect, I must admit. We done it a few times. She brought around and we used to drink it. I haven't done it since, frankly, but yes, has a cooling effect on your hot tea in a hot day.
The pickers, when you're out grape picking, where do you sleep? Where do you live?
Ah, he had some sheds which he had cleaned up. And we slept there. And the first night there was stuff that would not let us sleep. And then the next day he came and sprayed it with, I think they said morphine. And after that it was bearable. It was okay.
But
It was just tin sheds.
there were bugs everywhere, in other
Yeah,
words.
there were bugs everywhere. Yes,
And
yes, yes.
how long was the grape picking season?
I think we stayed there until early April.
And then back to Adelaide.
Then back to Adelaide, back to Kerry's Gully. We stayed there for a few weeks more, and my brother George and my father, they bought a house together in Torrensville, and we moved all the family there sometime in May, I believe.
How did your parents cope with the changing culture and, more importantly, the lack of the English language?
Well, my father had no problem with the English language because he had the same problem with the Greek language. So no, they coped well. There was the family. They used to be able to, after a while, get on a bus, go to town, and do those things. They used to be able to go to shops sometimes, when they need it, but most of the time, one of the kids would have been with them. I must say that both of them, my father died in 78, my mother in 83, so they roughly lived about 20 years here, and both of them would say, now we understood what life is meant to be like, because my father worked in the ENWS for most of the time. My mother did go up in the market gardens and worked weekends and this and that, but mostly she didn't. But they were content, they were happy, they didn't have the suffering and the problems that they had back home.
Now, you as a young man, did you start learning English?
Yes, yes, that's interesting. Yes, I started as soon as I could. I started going to evening migrant classes. I had determined that I will learn the language because I had an experience on the ship for the first time in my life. There were people, human beings around me. They used to speak and I could not understand. That was a new sensation for me, I've never had that experience before. So there and then I've sort of made a decision that where I go, I will learn the language to the extent that I'll be able to have a conversation with anybody about anything. And I tried very hard. I did not learn the language easily, as a lot of other people did. They learned by hearsay. I learned by studying. I went to migrant classes. I went to weekend migrant classes, and you know, for a long time, I went to higher classes, as it is. So I've tried to learn the language as much as possible. Although apparently my accent is not the best. My brother George used to say, "I don't understand how people understand you when you speak English." But there it is. I think I have a fairly reasonable command of the language. I speak English as well as I speak Greek, I think.
Now, well, you do have a very good command of the English language, and you have done a variety of jobs as well, haven't you?
Yes. Different jobs. As I said, I started in a market garden, then I went grape picking. After that, I got a job at a small factory on Anzac Highway. It was making automobile accessories, sunvisors and things like that. I worked there for a couple of years. After that, I went to another small factory at Torrensville. I think it was called ERG. That was making mainly steel door frames. And in 1963, I went and got a job at Chrysler's at Keswick. I worked there for about 3 months, I think, and then they sent me up to the new plant at Tonsley Park, at Chrysler's, where I worked until 1966. 1966 is the year that I got married, and after a while I left Chrysler's and I bought a fish shop in the Arendal Shopping Center together with my brother and somebody else. I had that for about 12 months. We sold that, and I worked for a couple of years at the Phillips in Hendon. I was three shifts. That wasn't the best of times. Working three shifts, it's not my cup of tea. I did that for a couple of years. And in 68 or 69, I got a job at a Continental Bakery, which was in town, delivering bread to shops and houses. I did that for a couple of years. And in that time, I got my real estate salesman's license, and I started doing that job part-time. After a while, I quit the bakery and I started doing real estate full-time, which I did until 1981 or 82. After that, I stopped the real estate because things were a bit squeezed and tight. I bought myself a cab, and I drove the cab for a while, for a few years, and then I bought another cab. We had drivers, then we bought a third one for my son Harry. We still have the cabs. I've only got the plates now. Last time I drove a cab was in 1998, I think. After that, I went back to real estate until my retirement when I was 65, and I sort of stopped work. I'm retired now. I'm what you call a self-funded retiree. And life goes on, hopefully.
You've done very well, Michael. Let's go back now. You're in your early 20s, and Mum says, "Michael, time to marry you off."
Tell us
what happened.
I was early 20s. They tried to marry me off. And there were some girls here that we saw and whatever, but nothing eventuated. And one day I was writing a letter back to my sister in Greece, in the village. I was the one that was doing the correspondence because both my parents were illiterate. My brother Paul, he was hardly home. He usually worked in the country, those days. So I was doing the correspondence. And when I was, as I was writing the letter, my mom says, tell your sister to find you a girl from Greece. So without thinking much about it, I just wrote it down as a joke, more or less. Anyway, the letter went, and another letter came, and the letters were exchanged after a while. I don't know whether it was months or what. We get this letter, and they tell me that they found me a girl. She's from that village, and her name is such. And there is a photograph of a girl, and they want a photograph of me. And I thought, oh, gee, this is getting serious now. What the hell am I going to do? So I wrote back and I said, look, forget it. It's not, you know, I'm not up to it. And they would not have a bar of it. They said, look, we gave our word to the people, and, you know, you told us, you wrote to us to find your girl. We find your girl. It's a good girl, this and that. Anyway, to cut a long story short, I went along with it. I sent a photograph. They sent another. We started corresponding with the girl's family. And one thing led to the other. And in 1966, Evanthea came to Australia. And we got married that year, in June of that year. And that was that, I suppose. We had two kids. Theoharis, who was born in 1967, and Timoleon, who was born in 1974. They were 7 years apart, and there was a good reason for it. We thought we'll stay with one kid. But then when Harry was growing up, and his cousins and the people that he knew, our friends, all had brothers and sisters, he started asking for either a brother, a sister, or a dog. So we decided to give him a sister, but it became a brother.
Rather than a dog.
Rather than a dog. And that was how I got married with the photograph. I know it sounds strange, and frankly, my friends at the time, when they heard that I was bringing a girl from Greece, they could not believe it, because I wasn't supposed to be that kind of a person. But it did happen. It started as a joke, as far as I was concerned. But I've got no regrets, and I think my wife hasn't got any, or at least she doesn't say as much. I think the thing to say about it is this, that people that meet us today, years later, that and we know each other for a couple of years, 2 or 3 years, and along came the information that we got married with photograph, they could not believe it, because we seem to be so suited to each other. So there it goes. When my second grandson was about 7 or 8 years old, asked his grandmother how many times you saw grandpa and you married him. And what could she say? She said, I did not see him. We married with the assistance of a photograph, and the kid looked at her bewildered, and she said, we married with the internet, and he understood that. So now, since then, whenever the occasion arises, we say we married with the internet. The internet of the time.
Exactly. Well, your sister knew you. She knew her brother quite well, and chose well for you.
Yes, I must admit, yes, she did that.
Yes.
She did very well.
Now, have you been back to Kozani?
Yes, we've been back to Kozani for the first time in 1977.
Can you remember, how did you feel going back to your village?
Going back to Greece was ecstatic. I remember jumping on a cab at the airport and asking the driver to take us to a hotel somewhere in the center of the town. And as she was driving, she turned the corner onto a main road, and I saw the Acropolis in front of me. Even today, give me Give me the shivers. It was unbelievable. The village, when I met my wife's family, that was another different kind of feeling. They were all people that they knew me for years, or I knew them. It was all excited, it was all good. When I went to the village, I could not see enough of it. I could not take enough of it in me. It was all so wonderful.
Did you feel you were going back home?
I must say yes, even though the home wasn't there. The actual home that I grew up wasn't there, because they had demolished it and built a new one, my sister and her husband and her family. But yes, it felt like going home. And even now, when we go back, and we've been back 5 times, it still feels home. But also coming back feels home as well.
That first time you went, how long did you stay?
We stayed 3 months, which is the normal thing for Greeks from Australia to do.
Yes.
I don't know why.
When time came for you to leave and come back to Australia, what did you feel?
Well, that's an interesting point. I had done a thing that I left to live to maximize the time that I could stay in Greece for 3 months, and I left it to the last day to leave. And I had a problem with the army, because I did not go to the Greek army, and because I was in my 30s, I could only stay 3 months. A day over, they could grab me and send me to the army. So I left to the last day. I thought I'll leave on that day. But such is luck. We went to the airport in Athens to leave at about 10 or 11 o'clock that evening. And wouldn't you know it, there was a strike in London, and the Singapore airline would not come through until the next morning. So the next morning, technically, I could be stopped from migrating. But the person that looked at our papers, you know, sort of, the other didn't realize, or didn't want to bother, or felt sorry for me, or whatever. Let us go through. Yes, it was like coming home.
Both ways.
Both ways, it's coming home. But I do believe that coming home to Australia feels more like home.
Mm-hmm. When your children were growing up, did you send them to Greek school?
Yes, we'd send them both to Greek school. In fact, with the first one, we did something that most of us Greeks in Australia, and I suppose other nationalities, thought they should do. Being a typical good Greek, I thought the kid will learn English no matter what. I mean, you know, we are in Australia. So our duty is to teach him the Greek language. And you can do that before he goes to school. So we kept speaking to him in Greek, and he knew the Greek language well, fairly well. When he went to school, he could hardly speak any English. But what the heck? He learned the language, no problems. And we didn't think much of it. Until on the second grade, I went one day to pick him up, which mostly I did because I was doing real estate at the time, and I had the time. And he got into the car, and as we were coming home, he said to me in English, "Dad, I wish I was an English kid." And I looked at him. I sort of laughed and said, "Why?" He said, so I can understand what the teacher is talking about. At that moment, it hit me. The mistake that we did by not teaching the kid both languages. And Harry finished the high school, did not go any further, and school was hard for him. And I do believe, because of the fact that the first couple of years at school he was left behind because of the language problem, that kept him back. And after that, we, with my wife, we decided that with Timmy, And with Harry, I will be speaking to the kids English and she will be speaking Greek. Both kids speak reasonably good Greek. Timmy also did his matric in Greek, and that's how he got into uni. He writes reasonably well, and he can read reasonably well, although he could have done better. But as far as the grandkids are concerned, with Harry's kids being of mixed marriage, their mother is Italian, they did not learn any of other language, either Greek or Italian. They only speak English. But I think that was a mistake that a lot of Greeks did, that I know of. They put too much emphasis on the kids learning the Greek language. The emphasis should have been on learning both languages. So when the kid went to school, he wasn't behind the eight ball.
How important was it for you, for your children, to learn the Greek language?
We felt it our duty, and I still think it's our duty to teach our kids our language, our customs, our heritage. And let's face it, our heritage, I mean, I've got nothing against anybody else, and everybody should be proud of their heritage. But our heritage is a bit more than the average heritage of most people. So there's no reason why our kids should not speak the language, and especially they should not know our heritage, or their heritage, for that matter. Yes.
Thank you very much, Michael. It's been a very, very informative, very interesting interview. Is there anything else that you would like to add that we haven't covered?
Not that I can think of, and I must thank you for giving me this opportunity to say my story. I don't know how good it was, but in a nutshell, that's what it is. I don't think there is anything of importance that I could add. I mean, that about covers it, I think.
Again, thank you very much.
Thank you.